He always seems to get involved, doesn't he?
I'm telling you, too many coconuts have hit him right on top of the skull.
Well, I think Anthony will be a great acquisition. He can do it all.
Avery, whose show is this?
And we're live. Welcome, everybody, here to the Lakers Lounge. I'm Anthony Irwin, joined on this fine Friday afternoon for an actually happy hour. We are actually, like, getting together. We're happy about the basketball that we just watched last night. I am joined by Jason Timpf. He is of the volume, and he is of hoops tonight. And he is one of my favorite people to talk hoop with. He is celebrating, fresh off celebrating an anniversary with the volume. Congratulations on all of that growth, man, and all of that success. Really cool stuff what you guys are doing over there. And I've been really rooting for your guys' success because it means that I might be able to parlay some of this into some success on my end as well. Jason, thank you very much for hopping on, man. How are you holding up?
I'm doing good, man. This roller coaster, it's funny. I said on my show in early January, I was like, I expect the Lakers to be terrible and awesome at least a few more times before the deadline. And it's been like five different swings. It's like after that, yeah. Hawks game, you would have been as gloom and doom as you could possibly be. And now it's like, man, if they beat the Knicks tomorrow, all of a sudden it looks pretty good.
I was literally dressed up in Joker attire after the Houston game, like had the makeup on and everything. And no, here we are only like within a week of that. And I'm like, you know, look at that, you know, it's a weird team that we're going to be talking about here. And actually, I think that's a perfect launching point. It's slightly different from the show plan or whatever, but you mentioned these wild swings, right? And after last night's game, I had it texted to me. I mentioned him on last night's show, but Mark Stein texted me. He was like, hey, because I've been beating the drum of I think Darvin needs to go, and the reason for it is I think he's lost the locker room, and Mark fairly made the point that if a coach had lost the locker room, that you wouldn't get that kind of effort that you got Thursday night when the Lakers beat the Celtics. Perfectly fair thing to point out, but I kind of felt like while I was watching it, it felt like an FU game, right? It felt like they were making their shots and then immediately staring at Darvin, right? And then after the game, you had D'Angelo Russell kind of subtweet the coaching staff a little bit, saying that Christian Wood played the way he did and Jackson Hayes played the way that he did, because they knew that they weren't going to get pulled every single time they missed a shot. And I don't know. Where I wanted to start with you is I know that you play basketball at one of the higher levels of anybody who, you know, does this typically. And I'm sure you've been in locker rooms where there wasn't as much faith in a head coach, or if the coach had lost the locker room altogether. And I feel like that's where you would kind of see it show up, is those violent swings from incredible basketball like we saw Thursday night and just not caring at all like we saw in the two games prior. Am I making that assessment fairly? Is that kind of where that would show up, or do you think it's, you know, there's no real correlation there?
So for starters, I disagree with Mark Stein's assertion there, just from the standpoint of, like, I think basketball players are competitive and they love to play basketball for the most part. Most basketball players are like that. I think that even in the environment where you're frustrated with the coaching staff, where you're frustrated with the schematic approach, where you're frustrated with rotations or whatever it is, I think you can also still love basketball and love to compete in spite of that. And I actually was the worst team I was ever on was my first year playing. It was a community college here in Tucson. And it was just an absolute disaster from start to finish in the season. I think we went 4-25. But there was a specific game. The best team in our conference was a school from Phoenix called South Mountain. And they actually came down and they were, you know, consistently, you know, 20, 25 wins every single year. And we were terrible, riding like a 7-game winning streak. But we ended up battling them in this crazy game where we nearly beat them. We ended up barely losing just at the end. And it's like, because We had some good players on our team. We have pride. We love playing basketball. And what we did when we saw South Mountain come into the gym is we saw an opportunity. We saw a challenge. And we wanted to kind of test ourselves. And that's what I think this is. In a lot of ways, like the Lakers are not a team that has a talent issue, in my opinion. They have a roster balance issue. And then they have a coaching issue, which we're going to get into. But like these are good basketball players that have a lot of pride. And I think they walked in there and like, of course, everyone's saying this game's over. Boston's going to run them over. Of course, everyone's saying without LeBron and AD, they have no chance. But it's like, no, Austin Reeves is good. D'Angelo Russell is good. Jared Vanderbilt's good. Rui Hachimura is good. Jackson Hayes, these guys are good. They're good basketball players and they want to go out there and they want to show what they can do. And honestly, like, one of the big reasons why I was encouraged about the Lakers as a regular season team was the simple fact that they have a good amount of player archetypes without LeBron James and Anthony Davis. They've got some big athletes without LeBron James and Anthony Davis. Now, that was not the case in years past. Yeah. They have legitimate shot creation beyond LeBron James and Anthony Davis. That was not the case in years past. So they actually can put out a reasonable basketball product. I think actually it was more of an indictment of the effort and energy and focus consistency throughout the season that they went out and beat Boston last night. Like Torian Prince, for instance, I'll give you Torian as an example. Torian, ironically, was the one player without a positive plus minus last night, which is like objectively funny given the narrative. But I actually thought Torian played a freaking amazing basketball game last night by his standards, especially in the second half. I thought he was super active on the glass. He got a bunch of like kind of 50-50 balls where I was like,
Drew late. That forced Drew to kind of step out of bounds on the sideline there. That closeout, I thought, was like a game-saving type play.
He was great. He had some good dribble penetration. He had a couple of big, like he was, I thought Torian played really well. And like, and honestly, like the issue is, in my opinion, is like some of this is on the players. I want to be clear. Like when we discuss Darvin, I think it's important to acknowledge, like, especially after the in-season tournament, that was a group that had a sense of accomplishment. And they already had effort issues before then. As we know, even a lot of their wins were like games where they looked like shit for three quarters and then they came back and won in the fourth, you know? And it's like they had like an opportunity to exhale after the in-season tournament. And then it's like they immediately lose a Dallas game they shouldn't have lost. They immediately lose to the Spurs, like who hadn't lost a game or hadn't won a game in a month or whatever. So a lot of it is like, I think that actually shines a brighter light on that specific flaw. Now, as far as the losing the locker room idea, I think it's different than a lot of other situations you'll see because the Lakers have so much talent. And I think part of the issue is like, I think I don't have any sourcing on this, and maybe you can kind of clarify, but I'm of the opinion that those guys wanted Darvin to get fired. And a lot of it was pouty, passive aggressive play kind of geared towards that front. And like we can get into more of the X's and O's stuff in a minute, but like I think that was the gist of it. I think the Lakers were passive aggressively trying to send a message in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think there was some of that. I just think generally those six guys, you know, not counting Max, right? He would make seven, but those six guys who went on that run to the Western Conference Finals, like when you go on a long playoff run like that, there's a like brotherhood that gets formed, right? You look at those human beings differently than you did before that run. And I think a lot of those guys or all those guys came into the season thinking like, all right, we saw what we could do last year with basically no margin for error. Now let's see how we could build on it. And then to have the head coach, like, you know, kind of almost immediately quit on the Austin and D'Angelo Russell pairing. And then it took forever for him to start to believe in Jared Vanderbilt. Unfortunately, he got hurt last night and we'll see how long that holds him out again as well. Rui's role has been all over the map this year. And I really think that, to your point about like they wanted him gone, I think now last night, I think everybody's kind of coming to the realization he isn't, right? Rob and Jeannie really believe in Darvin. I think they have some of their own reasons for that belief as well that extend beyond basketball. And I do kind of think that like last night I reported going into the game that they were getting ready to start last year's starters, right? They were like, had LeBron and AD not play or had they played, had they been available, you would have gotten the D'Lo, Austin, Vando, LeBron, AD lineup. And I was told by some of the people closer to the situation that there was like a legitimate like, ooh, you know, like some a real vibe, you know, in the locker room of like, all right, hell yeah, let's go. And I think we saw that, by the way, in the Golden State game, where that was the group that played all through that overtime. And I think that's why we got the immediate downturn when they went right back to the starters with Torian in there, right? In the very next couple games, it's like those guys, they're more than half of your rotation. They're a big old chunk of your locker room, and an even bigger part of your culture, I think, in that locker room. And I think those waves that you ride, positive or negative, have a lot to do with the opportunity that those guys are getting. And I thought last night when those guys had that opportunity and coming out and in that Golden State game, like the best that the Lakers have looked is when more of those guys feel like they get to tangibly affect the game. And, you know, that kind of brings us to Darvin. That's driven me insane. Is that like it's staring at me right there in terms of like, I think it makes the most basketball sense. I think it makes the most human being sense to go with those six guys. How have you been watching this season? Have you been driven as insane as I have? Watching those guys, I think they've played 30 minutes or so together so far this year, that starting group from last year's playoff run, and 19 of those minutes came in that Golden State game. I've been driven insane by it. How have you taken all this in?
You know, it's funny because like I really do try to see the reasoning behind like what a coach's thought process is. And honestly, what I really think it comes down to is Darvin Ham galaxy brain to this whole thing. Like I think he overthought it. And so let's kind of like set the stage by acknowledging the reality that at the beginning of the season, Vando was hurt. So
And
you look at it and Austin was tired. So you look at it and you go, okay, I can't really put Rui at the three because then I don't have a point of attack defender on the floor. And I think Darvin, even though Torian to me is like an extremely mediocre perimeter defender, Darvin, I think, views him as like a legitimate top, like a number one head of the snake type of defensive option. So yep. I think Darvin looked at it as like, okay, am I going to go with Rui or would I rather have him kind of come in for LeBron as that four and I'll put Torian Prince in there? That I think made sense at the time, at the start of the year. And a lot of times too, you have to see something happen before you figure out what works and what doesn't, right? So then we find out pretty quickly at the start of the season, it's like, oh, Austin D'Lo Torian is just not athletic enough on the perimeter to have any sort of real success. And so then we go into the phase where he's messing with the skill guards, right? Now we're taking D'Angelo Russell out of the starting lineup. We're taking Austin Reaves out of the starting lineup. That to me made some sense, right? Like I didn't agree with benching Austin in particular first. I think a lot of the problems could have been solved by having D'Lo kind of play that sixth man role, but with the same level of aggression that he's had as of late, because he was super passive when he was in that sixth man role when he first went there. So so you bring in Cam Reddish into that two spot, and it's like, okay, now we've got a better head of the snake type of perimeter defender there. That made some sense. But then the clear problem was you're leaving your best players on the bench. It's like, if you're ranking the Lakers top six players, like Jared Vanderbilt's in there, Austin Reaves is in there, Rui Hachimura is in there. And so you're keeping three of your very best basketball players out of that lineup, which can be a problem, right? Then Darvin does like this. This is where it gets really galaxy brainy. He's like, screw it, let's put all the athletes out there,
all
right?
Wings, let's go.
and it doesn't make any sense. And then for him to be like, okay, now consistency is the issue. So let's go back to what we did at the start of the season, even though we have a gigantic sample size of evidence that it doesn't work.
Yeah.
To me, like the Austin Reaves, D'Angelo Russell, Jared Vanderbilt, LeBron AD lineup has the best combination of keeping as many of your best players on the floor as possible within the context of what a working lineup needs, while also checking those boxes. Like, you need to have a top tier high motor athlete in your starting lineup if you are a serious basketball team. End of story. Forget about it. Like, that is an absolute necessity. If you look at Denver, it's like it's KCP and Aaron Gordon, right? You look at Boston, all of them really are, right? Like you have to have that kind of athlete that is not one of your stars that can just take on those dirty work responsibilities. And it's so obvious to see. It's like, oh, when Jared's out there, he just does a lot of the more difficult stuff, which allows your other four players to lean into what they're good at. And honestly, like, I'm encouraged to hear, because I hadn't actually seen that report yet from you, I'm encouraged to hear that they're leaning in that direction. And I hope Jared Vanderbilt's injury doesn't limit his ability to make that a reality. But like, I think at the end of the day, that actually kind of paints their strategy kind of heading into the deadline too.
Yes.
Because like I tend to think that if Darvin has concerns about Jared Vanderbilt, whether it's his ability to stay healthy or it's to impact the game offensively like Torian Prince can or whatever it is, then you need to provide Darvin with essentially a shoe-in option for that specific role. And that becomes the goal at the deadline.
Yeah, I think they could really use an upgrade at their shooting guard spot. And the guy that I have always really, really wanted for them there is Gary Trent Jr. Like, I just think he makes a whole bunch of sense on both sides of the ball. He can play with both. Like, it seems like the Lakers are more interested in keeping D'Lo now than they were, say, at the beginning of the year. He can work with both D'Lo and Austin. I just think he has a cool game. Like, I just think it makes a lot of sense there. We'll see what they're able to do there. I know their focus is more on Bruce Brown, but I think his price is too high. I don't think they're going to be able to make that work.
Bruce Brown is my dream. That's the guy that I think, like, if Bruce Brown, I think Bruce Brown makes Torian Prince a more feasible three, even though I'd still prefer him to be in a smaller minutes role. But like, Bruce Brown to me is that like two guard version of Jared Vanderbilt while also being a plus offensive player. That to me is what Bruce Brown is.
Well, that's why the Lakers really, really wanted him in the summer, right? And thought that they were going to get him before Indiana made that balloon contract with him and you know, wound up losing out on him and you know, had to rebound and all of that stuff the way that they did. But yeah, I do really agree. And actually, that's a perfect segue to what we think the Lakers should maybe keep their eye on here heading into the deadline. I just wrote for Substack about the deadline in general and how it's developing a lot more slowly than a lot of the buyers would have liked, right? You had that flurry of activity with Toronto moving Pascal Siakam and OG Anunoby. And I guess now you've had the Steven Adams move, but that doesn't really affect either team's basketball interest for this year. And I think the Lakers, along with other buyers at the deadline here, are you know, kind of frustrated with the asking prices from a lot of these teams, right? Dorian Finney-Smith apparently got, you know, the Nets turned down a trade offer for two first round picks for Dorian Finney-Smith. And Tyus Jones was expected to fetch a first rounder, even though he's a restricted or an unrestricted free agent at the end of the season, and is like overqualified to be a backup point guard, but probably underqualified to be a starting point guard. Bojan Bogdanovic, the Detroit Pistons are asking for Austin Reeves for him. It's like, nope, not doing that. So the Lakers are kind of frustrated with the asking prices right now. And I think they're kind of preparing for a somewhat quiet deadline. But aside from what you just talked about, is there anything in particular that you would like to see the Lakers upgrade in the next week or so?
So I as I've kind of looked around, DeJounte Murray is not my favorite option. But I do like the prospect of having a guy on the team that can actually beat people off the dribble. That to me is something that I find interesting. I also think that there is a possibility that he could come in and be an impact defensive player. I think there's some risk there. I think there's some risk that he comes in and is underwhelming on that end of the floor, but I think there's some possibility there. Bruce Brown, as I mentioned, is my favorite option because I just think he gives you your basically your two-way version of Vando at the two and gives you some flexibility. Like, I think if you had Bruce Brown on the team, you could even get away with Rui at the three if you needed to do that because of the fact that he would just have an easier perimeter assignment. I think Austin Reeves has shown that when you give him the second best perimeter defender that to guard, that he can at least do a like an okay job on him and like a job that's not going to actively hurt your team. You know what I mean? But at the end of the day, I think the number one strategy has to be you have to come up with a clear five. I think when you look around the league, it's very clear who everyone's at the top of the league, who their core five is. Like, Denver's going down with Jamal Murray, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Michael Porter Jr., Aaron Gordon, and Nikola Jokic. The Celtics are going down with Jrue Holiday, Derek White, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, and Kristaps Porzingis. The Milwaukee Bucks are going to go down. I don't think they can, with how well Malik Beasley's shooting the ball, and he honestly has been defending a little bit better as of late. Like, I think they're going to go down with Dame and Beasley and Chris Middleton and Giannis and Brooke Lopez, right? Like, if you go down the league, everyone kind of knows who their five is. And for the Lakers, there's just some question marks there. And as much as we've been begging for the Jared Vanderbilt starting lineup adjustment, that is not because it's the end-all be-all for their playoff capability. That is 1,000% just your best chance to win regular season games, which at this point is like paramount.
You really need to do it.
You really need to do it. Like, you can't just keep hemorrhaging points at the beginning of games and halves, right? So,
Did you see the quote from Darvin the other day? It was like, you know, for some reason, the first and third quarters, we just really have a hard time. Darvin.
I didn't see that quote right after the game, but I just saw it for the first time yesterday. And I was like, hold on, that sounds like a bit. Is he doing a bit? Like, what's going on?
Darvin, you know, anyway, all right, go ahead, Darvin.
But yeah, so I do think you've got to find a way to kind of consolidate that. Here's the thing. I already liked D'Angelo Russell from last year. I've just looked at it as some of the realities of his playoff limitations. But like, I've gained a mountain of respect for him this year on so many different levels.
Last night especially. Oh my God. Like the ability to impact a game positively when you aren't shooting the ball. Like, that's the thing. That's the question I have about him. And by the way, like, you know, I wrote about this for Substack today too. The Lakers were impressed by that. Like, as much as everybody went nuts about the scoring that he did the prior 2 weeks, what I've been told actually is that last night was actually the game that a lot of people in the Lakers organization were like, oh, that's new. You know, the rebounding, the passing, the maintained confidence, the vibe increase. Even when, you know, Boston would go on a run, he was there to pick things up a little bit. That's new, man. Like, in a big game like that, that's really new for him. But sorry, go ahead.
No, you're fine. To your point, it's such a huge credit to D'Angelo Russell. And like, even beyond the play, which, by the way, he's just playing the best basketball of his career right now. Just to put it simply, that's what he's doing.
Absolutely.
His professionalism all season, even though, like I said before the season, that I thought D'Angelo Russell getting traded was one of the safest bets in the NBA. And obviously that was before he played the best stretch of basketball of his career here in the last couple of weeks. But I think I wasn't alone in thinking that. I think a lot of people kind of saw
it. The Lakers thought that.
Yeah, they structured his contract that way. So so for him to basically come into this essentially being a temporary mercenary, and for him to handle it the way he has, it just being a leader to the young guys, like pumping them up and making them feel good about themselves, embracing whatever role the team asks him to embrace, like he even on the heels of this, or right on the doorstep, I should say, of this trade deadline with how well he's been playing, I've been so unbelievably impressed. That said, I do think it would be a mistake if the Lakers held on to him if it got them a good player. Meaning, like, if they pulled out of a negotiation when a deal was on the table because they wanted to keep D'Angelo Russell, I believe that would be a mistake. And the answer is just really simple. It's resource management. Like, as much as I think D'Angelo Russell has been playing his ass off, do I think the Lakers can win a championship with Austin Reaves and D'Angelo Russell starting and closing games at the 1-2? No, I do not. So... Yeah. That to me is the beginning and the end of the discussion. And so from there, if you have the ability to use his salary to bring back a player that can fit into that five, I think you have to do so. Because then what you're doing is you're bringing everything closer to a five that makes some sense. And I think honestly, like have you heard anything about Gabe Vincent? Is he going to most likely be able to come back before the end of the season?
They are really skeptical that he's going to be able to.
It's
a really tricky injury that he's dealing with here. It's kind of like, you remember with Kendrick Nunn, right? He dealt with the knee contusion, right? And so essentially with Gabe, he's dealing with swelling that then becomes a contusion. And then you have to recover from both, right? And he had the surgery on it that Nunn didn't get. And that kind of improves the likelihood that he had that he might be able to come back this year. But then you're hoping that a guy coming off of knee surgery helps you in the season that he got knee surgery. So I'm told the Lakers are being pretty active in trying to get his name out there in trade talks.
That makes sense. I'm not looking at him as like a guy who could fit into that five, but like, man, if he could somehow come back in March and just basically be a bench guard, that would certainly be useful. But yeah, like when I look at like an ancillary move for a Dorian Finney-Smith, if that was possible, if I looked at a DeJounte Murray move, a Bruce Brown move, like Gary Trent Jr. is actually a good option as well. But like if you can find some way to bring in a real two-way athlete that is just clearly one of your five best players that can start at the two or the three, I just think that monumentally improves your chances. I just think it does. And I think if you are going to play D'Angelo Russell and Austin Reaves at the one and the two and close games with them, you would need a transcendently great three. You would need Jaden McDaniels as your three, a guy that is just like one of the very best two-way wings in the league, and they just don't have that option. And so to me, like, I hope the Lakers don't fall for this. Not, and I shouldn't say fall for it. I believe it. I think D'Angelo Russell got humiliated by Bruce Brown, went into the summer, worked his ass off, and got way better at basketball. Round of applause to D'Angelo Russell. Like we've talked about, gained so much respect for him. But this is a poor team construct if your intention is to win the NBA championship, and they've got to find a way to address that.
Yeah, the concern that I have is essentially, like, I think you can get away with having one guard who gets targeted, right? Steph, Dame, etc. The problem, like, with those Portland teams is that they also had CJ McCollum, and then they also had Anthony Simons, right? And like, when you have two guards who on any given possession can be targeted, that's where you really run into some postseason problems. And that's the case here with D'Lo and Austin, is that on any given possession, a team can look on one side of the court or the other and, okay, there's food over there. Oh, look, shoot, there's food over there, you know? And I think the Lakers need to address that in one way or the other, even though, like, I do kind of think that Austin's defensive woes are pretty circumstantial. Like, I really liked the way that there was a lot more pre-rotation done, and that, like, even as recently as the in-season tournament, I thought that a lot of the defensive concepts when he was out there made a lot more sense, and for some reason they've gone away from it. But, you know, that kind of brings us back to the center issue being Darvin this season. I want to discuss also the notion of, like, we've talked about the stuff that they need to do on the perimeter. How much do you buy into bringing somebody to help with a specific matchup? Because I think no matter what, your path to the finals is going to go through Denver. Like, I think they're clearly the best team in the conference, and the Lakers don't have a single person on this team right now who I feel at all comfortable throwing on Jokic. And physically, no matter what it might be, right? Even if it's just like, hey, beat the crap out of them for six fouls, I don't think they have anybody who can even do that. What do you think about upgrading on the front court to specifically address stuff that you're going to see in the postseason eventually?
So it's more just one of those things where, of all of the list of issues that the Lakers have, let's just use this as an example. Mm-hmm. If the Lakers could stand pat everywhere else but go get Andre Drummond, do I think that gives them a better chance at beating Denver than if they were to not get a backup center, but they got Bruce Brown or an Alex Caruso?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would rather have Bruce Brown or Alex Caruso. So it's more just a once again, coming down to, like, kind of resource asset management. Like if you could do a real easy kind of contract flip type of deal where you get a guy back, then sure. But to put it simply, like, I almost would look almost just purely on the margins there. Like, okay, here's a second round pick and a guy that's outside of your rotation, or let's get a guy in the buyout market before I would consider moving any sort of asset for something like that. I feel this way about most teams, by the way. Like, every team, it's like, I've seen Denver fans talk about how they need a bench player. I've seen Celtics fans talk about how they want a bench wing. And it's like, yeah, ideally, you could fill every hole on your roster, and that'd be great.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, like, if you got to me, it's like, step one is who's your five. Like, step one is who's your five. And if you don't know who your five is, addressing problems on the back end while leaving those unaddressed, I think, is a huge mistake. And so I agree with you. Like, do I think Jackson Hayes is going to be able to play backup center in the conference finals conference semis against the Nuggets? No, I don't.
Yeah.
Do I think Christian Wood can? Probably not. But I think, like, the Nuggets had literally one of the worst benches in the league last year and won the title because their best five guys was just way better than everybody. When you scale minutes up and you can find a way to, like, do you remember in the Grizzlies series, which was like they got blitzed in all the LeBron minutes, the LeBron at center minutes, but, like, they also, like, wouldn't match AD's minutes with Jaren Jackson for whatever reason. So, like, Jaren Jackson would be out there without the Lakers having a big on the floor. It's like, you can do things like just match AD's minutes to Nikola Jokic. And you know what? Yeah. I do think a LeBron, Rui, Vando frontline could win minutes against DeAndre Jordan. I just do. So, like, it's more about, like, get your five. Get your five. If you don't know who your five is, then everything you need to do has to be geared towards getting who your five is.
That's what's been so frustrating from this season, is that, like, how do you not have any idea on that before you go into these negotiations, right? Like, yeah. That's just, it's malpractice, like, to not have any understanding on that front going into the most important week of the season from a personnel standpoint is just crazy to me. And yeah, some of it's circumstantial, like we talked about at the top, but at the end of the day, those five guys only getting that much time together and not having any idea if they have in fact improved collectively before you go into this week is just insane. All right. Like, last 10 minutes here before we have to let you go. You have been on something recently that I could not possibly agree with more, and that's your takes on refereeing in the NBA and rewarding the foul baiting and rewarding some of these moves that, you know, you have an offensive player who, like, dribbles into a defensive player, flails madly and hopes to get a couple free throws out of it, and how in the regular season that gets rewarded. And I think it goes away in the postseason. That's why a lot of those players and teams really tend to struggle when those calls go away. As you have been talking about this as much as you have you gotten any, like, feedback on why those rules exist the way that they do, other than the league is hoping that those inflated stats get more fans to the screen?
I don't think it's that necessarily, because I actually do think the league, I mean, we've seen it in some of the adjustments they've made in terms of, like, trying to take out non-basketball plays, although they've done a terrible job of it. At least it's their intention. I've talked to some people that have like done a lot of research on this specifically and kind of picked their brains about it. And from what I understand, to me, it's a fundamental difference between, like, the letter of the law versus discretion. And that's the thing. Like, if you really get down to what grifting is. So, for instance, it's let's talk about Jason Tatum's little stupid drop step move that he used at the end of the game last night, where he didn't get the call, where he kind of stuck his arms out, just, like, went up like this and didn't get the call.
Yep.
So, like, on that play, what he's hoping for is, like, he's technically in a shooting motion, right? Like, he's technically gathering up into a shooting pocket, but he's hoping that he can catch an arm on his arms. Now, by the book, that is a foul, and that is why that gets called so much. I mean, we even saw last night there was a low gather that Jalen Brunson used on kind of like a step through move as he was driving to the basket for what basically ended up being the dagger against the Pacers, right? And what it is he's doing a unnatural gather down low on purpose, in intending to draw contact across his arms. And so, like, that is a letter of the law approach, and, like, it's really simple. Like, you can break it down to somebody, you can even tweet that out and be like, this call's BS, I don't like this, and you'll have dozens of people going, like, he hits him on the arm, it's clearly a foul. And it's like, the problem is we have to remember fundamentally, kind of like with our jobs, like, as people who cover the NBA, like, at the end of the day, we're doing this to make money, right? So, like, we want to have, we have to, there has to be a certain decision-making process geared around, like, what's best for the show, right? The same thing goes for the league, right? At the end of the day, this is an entertainment product. I have dreams and hopes in my lifetime, and I'm sure you do too, that, you know, 20, 25 years from now, it's even more a global game, that the NBA could have unbelievably untapped potential overseas and all these different things. Like, I believe in the long-term potential of the NBA, but you need the television product to continue to get better and better. And so, well, the problem is the letter of the law is interfering with the television product and making it ugly in a lot of cases. And in-season tournament championship game where I was complaining the most, I think, where it was like a foul call every 10 seconds. That was bothering me so much. I can't remember which game it was, but it was one of those. Like, it can legitimately ruin a game. It can ruin a game. And so I think it comes down to two things. One, a fundamental misunderstanding of what a referee's job is in the NBA, which is, like, your job is to make sure a smooth basketball game takes place, not to officiate the rules. Your job is not to inflict the rules on everybody.
You're not a hall monitor. You're there.
You're a facilitator of a basketball game. That is your job. And then problem number two, in my opinion, is there are way too many officials that don't have a basketball background. And some of this is on the NBA, and I think they need to do a better job of just kind of getting out to, I don't know if there's a way to recruit and, like, advertise to these kinds of people, but they need to be targeting former college basketball players and former overseas pros and guys who have had a lot of hands-on experience in the game to be officials because they will have a much better time navigating the discretion of what should and should not be called in an NBA game. So if we can figure out how to get refs to understand that their ego doesn't matter, they are here to facilitate basketball games and nothing more. And then two, we figure out how to make the basketball product look more like basketball by having the discretion calls made by former basketball players. I think those two things would go a long way towards fixing the problem, but I'm not optimistic.
Yeah, on that front, I think there needs to be a general rule, like almost like a commandment that like, you know, you have like certain commandments that like override whatever the letter of the law might be. And number one to me for refereeing would be if the thing that is being done would start a fight in a pickup game, you can't reward it.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like if I was playing pickup or whatever, and I went up and I just like, you know, went up through somebody's arms to draw contact there. There's no free throws in pickup. There's no point in doing that. So you, like the person that I did that to would just be like, what are you doing? Right. Same goes for like some of the charge calls that you get where somebody drives into the lane, kicks it out. And then you have somebody purposely stand in front of them and hope to get knocked over. If I did that and somebody called, you know, if I did that and I called a charge and impacted a play and pick up that way, start a fight for sure. Like that would immediately launch a riot on that basketball court, and rightfully so. I would deserve to get my ass kicked for doing that. And I think if you're a referee and you see something that would get somebody's ass kicked on a basketball court, you can't reward them for that thing. And I feel like that would solve a lot of these things. And like, I think you have to have spent some time on a basketball court to understand those things. You know, you have to have played the game to understand that, like, yeah, that letter of the law is true, but like it's not within the spirit of the game. And I think that spirit of the game is what you're talking about. And, you know, also like this is, I think, kind of my fundamental issue with the league is contact that happens away from the basket is seen so differently right now than contact that happens near the basket. And I think that needs to be balanced out where, you know, like these, the Kawhi Leonard rule that exists because Kawhi landed on, Zaza's foot and is now a flagrant foul. Right. I understand why that exists the way that it does, but when you think about it and like jump shooters jump forward, guys who are closing out jump forward, and like this idea that you have this like landing zone rule that all these guys take advantage of and fall over anytime anybody is within like a foot of them, and it leads to these like three free throw attempts. I just don't think that's part of the game. That should be part of the game. And then you look at the contact that leads to three free throw attempts compared to contact that is incurred and not called on the way to a basket. I just think that needs to be leveled out. And I don't, how would you go about doing that? I don't even know how you would. And the problem is too, the NBPA, I don't think really wants that either, because so many of their guys have lived fat and gotten, you know, nice stat lines off of those trips to the free throw line.
Yeah, it's complicated. The perimeter interior dynamic is interesting because I think it is like a little bit tougher to parse out than what would meet the eye. For instance, like there's a lot of two-way contact around the basket. So for instance, like I've never been that concerned about the way LeBron gets officiated because I want him to be able to hit you with his off arm, and I want him to be able to drop his shoulder, and I want him to be able to do a lot of that kind of stuff. Right. And so like, to me, it's like kind of a give and a take. And there is some reality to the fact that like, if I go to a step back jump shot and you kind of barely tap me on the forearm on my follow through, the shot's going to come two feet short of the rim.
Oh, for sure. You
know? So like, there's some truth to that. To me, it just keeps coming back to the grifting versus the playing basketball thing. And this is where discretion would kind of take hold is, you know, we already are getting so much stuff wrong. I'm okay with getting stuff wrong in the pursuit of improving the game. And so what I would do there is like, I'll give you an example. Let's say a guy comes over a ball screen and he gets free on the ball screen for a pull-up three, and he elevates. And as he's shooting, the dude who's pursuing from behind hits him on top of the head, and it causes an issue with the shot. That to me is a foul because the guard is playing basketball and he makes a basketball move to get to a basketball shot. and he gets fouled. When the dude who's defending the on-ball player is trying to sidle up over the top of the screen and he's kind of sort of attached, and the ball handler will just shoot right behind the screen and just throw some BS up at the basket, even though it's not a real basketball shot, to me, that's an example of a grift. You're not trying to make a basketball play, right? Now, they've actually already tried to legislate that specific shot out of it, right? But like, I would extend that to everything on the perimeter. So for instance, like when you see a guy around the basket drop his arms in a low gather to try to get through contact to go to the basket, I'd be like, I don't care if he rakes you across the arm and scratches you in the process. Not a foul, because you're not playing basketball. Yeah, exactly, because he's not playing basketball. And like,
that far out from your body, you deserve to get your arms like hammered to hell.
Oh yeah. I'll give you one last example. The Embiid face-up stuff. So forever, the face-up jump shot has been a big part of isolation post-up basketball. Specifically like clearing space, jab step, rise up and fire, right? Like Carmelo Anthony basically made his career out of that, right? You make the jab step to get separation, and you're trying to elevate outside of the defender's reach so that you can get a good, clean look, right?
Yep.
Joel Embiid is actually probing with his jab step to try to get you to hit him in the arms. It's the craziest thing. And it works. And so what's kind of funny is like one of the big parts of Joel Embiid's success as a mid-range shooter is nobody guards him there, because it's like if you do, you have just as much of a chance of getting a foul as you do of him actually missing the shot. And so it's one of those things where I would just allow discretion to win the day. I would go to the officials and I'd be like, look, we want basketball games to look more like basketball games. Let's, in the event that you see a player make a move with the soul that you said, you pointed out perfectly, in a pickup game would start a fight. Example is like the D'Angelo Russell shot last night where he drew two free throws in the late fourth quarter.
Yeah.
He drives to his left, holds his arm out with his right arm and kind of elevates up into the shot. That is a move that has no, D'Angelo Russell was not trying to make a pull-up jump shot there. He was trying to get to the foul line.
Yeah. Did you see where the ball ended up? It almost went over the backboard.
Yeah, he just threw it up at the rim. So, like, to me, that's where I would give the refs the discretion to be like, hey, yeah, you got fouled, but that's not basketball. Let's play on.
Yep, I agree completely. All right, I think that is all the time that we have you for you. Again, congratulations on all of the success that you have had with The Volume and On Hoops tonight. Find that channel, subscribe to it, and I promise you will thank me for helping you find it. I do got to say, you and I are both Star Wars fans here, and we got this news at the top of the show, and I do want to send us out with it. Apparently, Carl Weathers of The Mandalorian, obviously, he played Apollo Creed in Rocky. He passed away on Tuesday, and I do want to say, yeah, rest in peace to Carl Weathers. I loved his Mandalorian character, man. He looked like he was having so much fun acting in those shows, and just you could see him like absolutely chewing up every single one of his lines and loving every inch of the space he was given on that show. One of my all-time favorite actors and one of my all-time favorite characters. Rest in peace to Carl Weathers. But Jason, thank you very much for hopping on, man. I look forward to hopefully talking to you again here soon, and best of luck here for the rest of the season.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it, Anthony. It was always fun to chat, and I'm looking forward to doing it again soon, man.
All right. That'll do it for this week's content here in the Lakers Lounge. Make sure you guys hit that subscribe button, like all that good stuff, and we will be back with you guys on Sunday. Until then, I'm Anthony Irwin. That was Jason Timpf, and this has been the Lakers Lounge.